on this computer. So we're here at Matan. We're starting now Religious Judaism Encounters Religious Zionism. And this topic is obviously very apropos. We've just gone through Yom HaShoah, Yom HaTzma'ut, Yom HaZikaron, and Yom Yerushalayim is coming up next week. No better time to be discussing this. So Judaism Encounters Religious Zionism. What I want to do with you this afternoon is work through, I want to conceptualize different types of religious Zionist thinkers and place them into four categories of thought, because we're going to see that they, as a group, they don't all agree on everything. There's no unanimity around religious Zionist values and ideology. It sort of represents what happens in the Beit HaYehudi. There's no agreement about who should be in the government and who shouldn't and who should be a minister. It's all reflected. And there are some fundamental differences in opinion between great rabbis and great rabbanim about religious Zionism. But we studied in the last 2 weeks Zionism and then anti-Zionism. And religious Zionism, we're going to see, is, it's interesting to see to what degree it accepts aspects of Zionism, but rejects aspects of Zionism, and to what degree it accepts the critique of anti-Zionism. So it's going to be somewhere in between. So let's start with, it's an interesting question. Who's the first religious Zionist? Okay. Now, we would maybe argue, hey, they're Nachmanides, Ramban, and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest religious Zionist. Didn't he himself want to go in Eretz Yisrael? You know, growing up in my home, I put up a sign in my parents' kitchen. There was this little art piece of art of Moshe Rabbeinu saying, he's saying, God, can I please go into the land? And God says, no, you may not go into the land of Israel. And then it says on the bottom, what's your excuse? What's your excuse for not going to Israel? So you can argue Moshe Rabbeinu is the Halo Shoshana. Moshe Rabbeinu is the first real Zionist in Jewish history. But if we think about Zionism, in terms of starting from as a modern political movement, then we have to start with a person by the name of Rav Yaakov Reines. Rav Yaakov Reines is well known because he started an organization which many of us might have been associated with at different points in our life. Anybody know what that organization is? What is that organization that he started? Rav Yaakov Reines. He started Mizrahi in 1902. So a little bit about Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines. He was born in 1839, dies in 1915. He studies in the great Velazhner Yeshiva. I think he was a Talmud of the Netziv. He becomes an Av Beit Din, starts his own yeshiva, which was quite a revolutionary yeshiva. It was called Torah Umada, studied Torah, but also secular studies. Mm-hmm. Now, Rav Yaakov Reines encounters a guy by the name of Theodor Herzl, okay? And he is one of the first rabbis to agree to come to be part of the Zionist movement. You have to remember, most Orthodox rabbis were fiercely opposed to Zionism. As we can understand, Zionists didn't just want to, they throwing off, religious Judaism, they also wanted to establish a new Jew. They wanted to get away from the ghetto. They wanted to, and they even internalized, we saw certain anti-Semitic views of Jews. I'm not saying they were anti-Semitic, but again, they internalized the weakness, the weak, ghetto, pathetic Eastern European Jew, and they wanted to transform the Jew. So you can imagine that many rabbis were against Zionism. Now, Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines decides to join the Zionist movement. He wanted religious people to be part of this. It's an interesting question in life. Is it better to be on the outside and to, sort of give your opinion from the outside, or be in the inside and have influence on the inside? These are decisions we have to make all the time, different organizations and shul life, etc. But he decided he wanted to be part of the movement and that he would influence from the inside. And that's what Mizrahi was about. It's about bringing a religious spirit to Zionism from the inside. So in 1902, he establishes Mizrahi. Mizrahi is sort of an abbreviation for Merkaz Ruchani, a spiritual center. And they envision themselves as being the spiritual center of the Zionist movement. And this is an offshoot of Chibat Zion, a bunch of Rabbanim who were pro-Zionism at the time. And so Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines takes up the call of Zionism. Now, I don't have a good source to read on the source sheet with regards to Rabbi Reines, but I'll tell you briefly, because this is the opinion that we're going to spend the least time on. This is model number one of religious Zionism, and that is that there's anti-Semitism in the world. the Jewish people are, you know, they can't find a place for themselves in Russia. And the Poles, there's anti-Semitism there. There's anti-Semitism in the West. There's nowhere for us to go. We need to go to our own home. It's a very simple thing. We want to get away from anti-Semitism and go to the land of Israel, just the land that belongs to us, that Hashem promised to us. There's no grander, larger vision here about what's going to happen when we get to the land. It's just about, and this is actually very Herzlian in its view. Herzl was about establishing a state for the Jewish people. And according to Herzl, it didn't really matter where it was. I mean, he did feel attached to Israel. But remember, where was Herzl willing to establish the state of Israel?
Uganda.
And the truth is that in the beginning of Yitzchak Yaakov Reines voted along with Herzl. Because again, he felt there needed to be a refuge. That's the right word, a sanctuary. A refuge for the Jewish people to be able to get away from persecution and pogroms. And obviously, we all agree that place should be Eretz Yisrael. This is the religious Zionism of Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, okay, who establishes Mizrahi over 120 years ago. Okay, now that's model number one. Model number one is, we'll call it, more minimalist religious Zionism. Okay, and by the way, I want to thank a teacher of mine, Rav Nadi Helfgott, for teaching me about this. You know, four part. I once shared a long time ago. I've since expanded upon it, but you know, giving me these four categories, categories. That's model number one, Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines. But now we move on to model number two, and model number two is a little bit more expansive in its worldview about the opportunities that Zionism affords to the Jewish people. And I want to share with you two thinkers in model number two. Okay, now these two thinkers, one of them is his name is Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz, who some of you may have heard of, and the other one is Rabbi David Hartman. Okay, and I'm sharing with you, first of all, I'll just show you the books, but we'll look at the source sheet. Eliezer Berkovitz, this is Essential Essays on Judaism. Recently, it's put out a bunch of years ago, actually, when I was in the army, about 2002, by David Chazoni, and he wrote 18, 19 books. He was a great thinker, great Jewish thinker, lived in America in Skokie, Chicago. But this is an essential essays collection of his essays. The second book I'll be quoting from is a book called A Living Covenant by David Hartman, The Innovative Spirit in Traditional Judaism. Hartman is an Orthodox rabbi who was once a student of Rav Soloveitchik, but he moves away from Rav Soloveitchik. He's still Orthodox, but he's a little bit more on the hey, Boaz, you say hi. Say hi. Boaz, he just got back from Gaza, and he's making some trouble already.
Hi, Boaz.
Say hi. You want to say hi?
Yeah.
Okay, say hi, everybody. Say hi, my name is Boaz.
Hello.
My name is Boaz. Okay, go to mommy, okay?
My name is Tuxie.
No, that's not nice. Okay. Okay, no, don't take my mouse. You ran away with my mouse. One second.
Hi, Marilyn.
Hi.
Okay.
Thank you, Robin.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Schnitzel. Okay. Okay, go to mommy. Go eat your schnitzel in the kitchen. Okay. Okay. Let me just lock the door here. One second. Okay. Okay. You met Boaz.
We met Boaz.
He's a little maniac. Okay. So So I mentioned David Hartman, who's Orthodox, who's traditional, but on the more liberal end. So let's start with Eliezer Berkovitz, and I'm going to share with you the document right now with the sources. Okay, we're going to share it on the here, and I will send out all the sources to the whole group after this. Okay, so I'm just going to share this document right now and share screen. Okay, so Eliezer Berkovitz, this is an essay called on the return to Jewish sovereignty. So he says as follows, but what if the fruition of the idea as the deed encompasses the whole human existence? What if the faith seeks realization in economics, morals, politics, and every manifestation of human life? In that case, the group ought to be all-encompassing. Such a group should be mankind. But mankind is not a group. Well, sorry, I'm going to go down a little bit further. Okay, good, right here. The faith of Judaism requires such a comprehensive deed. Realization in the largest collective, mankind, is the ideal. The instrument of its realization in history is the people. Since our concern is with the comprehensive deed of Judaism, the people is Israel. Of necessity, the covenant had to create the power with which the covenant was concluded. What is he saying here? You know, we live, before the establishment of the state of Israel, Judaism was centered around the Beit Knesset, the Beit Midrash. This is a very local, parochial form of Judaism. But he's saying that if you look at Tanakh, if you look at Jewish history, our goal is to actually influence the world, to say something to the world about economics, about morality, about ethics of war, about health, about building, you know, all of these things. Judaism has something to say to the whole world. We have a universal message. The problem is that when you're sitting in shul and there are 30 people in shul and you're giving a drasha, the whole world is not hearing your drasha. There's no opportunity to share your vision with the world. Now, what is the best way to share your vision with the world? What's the instrument that you have to have in order to be able to do this? You need a country. You need a state. You need a country. You need a state. And if you have a country and a state, you can then demonstrate how the Jewish values can be implemented in this larger, you know, national context. If, however, the people of Israel is the instrument of realization, there must be a land. If Israel is the place of realization, there must be a place on earth in which a people are in command of their own destiny, where the comprehensive public deed of Judaism may be enacted. Now he says something very interesting about diaspora Judaism. Individuals may live in two cultures, but no distinctive culture may grow and flourish authentically in an area already preempted by another one. The individual Jew may well find a home in any democratic society. Judaism must remain in exile anywhere outside the land of Israel. Outside the land of Israel, Judaism is capable of partial realization. Outside of Israel, if you're in America, you're essentially Jews in an American context. South Africa are Jews in a South African context. Whereas in Israel, we have the ability to create our own society based on our own values. We can create our own destiny. The decisive areas of human endeavor are controlled by the majority culture. Okay, and this is the problem of being in Chutz La'aretz. Broad areas of Jewish teaching must remain mere book learning for the lack of applicability. Values and standards degenerate into pious intentions devoid of relevance because in the circumstances of Judaism's exile, they cannot become principles of policy for the Jewish people. Okay, now let's think about this for a second. I'll give you an example. Take ethics of war. I read an article in Makor Rishon a few months ago that spoke about everything that Israel does to prevent the loss of life when they attack terrorists in Gaza. They send smart bombs that just make noises. They make phone calls. They have drones overlooking to make sure that there are no kids running around in an area where there are terrorists. Israel does more than any other country in the world to save civilians in a battle, from the other side, enemies from the other side, okay? And these are not necessarily innocent people, but I don't want to get into that right now. And Israel is by far the most moral army in the world. Now, if you believe that your religion, which we do believe, has something to say about war ethics, how are you going to teach that when you don't have an army, when you're not able to defend yourself, when you are just citizens in a German or French or British or South African or American state? How do you show what it means to go to war as a Jew according to the views of Tanakh and Chazal? You have to be able to have an army. You have to have a state for that. And so according to Eliezer Berkowitz, and this is the second model of religious Zionism, why should we go back to Israel? Because being in Israel, creating our own state, enables us to live a full Jewish life. It enables us to fulfill our divine mission. It enables us to build a fully Jewish culture and society, as opposed to just having Judaism in the Beit Knesset, or Judaism in the Beit Midrash, or Judaism in the local school that you go to. Okay? And this one sort of way of connecting to this idea, or that this is brought out in the Tanakh, Here is, according to the Bible, Moses was not granted the privilege of entering the promised land. Informed the divine decree, he prayed, let me go over and see the good land. One of the teachers of the Talmud interpreting Moses' prayer in the Midrashic manner commented, why did our teacher Moses desire to enter the land of Israel? Was it so important for him to eat of its fruits and enjoy its good things? You could eat some fruits in Jordan. Rather, he thought there are so many commandments that Israel was given by God which can be fulfilled only there. Moshe wants to go into Israel to fulfill all of the mitzvot. Truma, and Maaser, and Orla, and Shemitah, and Yovel, all of these mitzvot which apply only in the land of Israel, you can't perform them outside of Israel. So Moshe wants to fulfill all of the mitzvot. And by extension, as Eliezer Berkovitz speaks about it, this is, we could build a full Jewish society in the land of Israel. This is why it's important for more mitzvah observance in the land of Israel more than in any other location. Okay? He goes on here. Those who separate Judaism from Zion, Torah from the land of Israel, give up both Torah and the land. Judaism without the opportunity for its comprehensive fulfillment is a spiritual tragedy. The longest period of its history, Jews have lived with it, but to embrace a tragedy as a desired form of Jews' existence is a falsification of the essence of Judaism. Who is he speaking to, Marilyn, right here? Who is he speaking to? Okay, this is Satmar, okay? What have they sacrificed? They have surrendered as a matter of principle Judaism raison d'etre, which is fulfillment in history. They've transformed its character by reducing to the level of religion. It's a personal, private religion, but it doesn't have anything to say to society or the world or economics or health or war or any of these things. Okay? Now, this is the position of Eliezer Berkovitz. Now, notice there's no mention of Mashiach. There's no mention of God's intervention. There's no mention of miracles. There's no atchalta de geula, the beginning of the redemption. We want to be in Israel so that we could fulfill the entirety of the Torah. Okay, and this could be expressed in different ways so that we could sort of rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, so we could fulfill all the mitzvot like Moshe Rabbeinu, so that we could build a fully Jewish society as Berkovitz speaks about. Now, the earliest person to share this is the predecessor to this idea in the most extreme form, at least in medieval sources, is actually the Ramban. And I want to share with you the Ramban inside. Again, I'll put, I just have two source sheets right now, but I'm going to put them together for you when I send it out. But if we look at Ramban here, can everybody see this source, Ramban? Is that large enough or should I make it a little bit bigger? Let me make it a little bit bigger. Page width. There we go. Okay. Now, Ramban, Nachmanides, he made Aliyah in the 1270s. Okay. This was under Crusader times. This was not an easy place to live. And the Ramban, see, right now we're in Model 2. Okay. So, Ramban here, he says something very interesting. He says, I'll just give you an example of something interesting that he says. You know, when Yaakov marries two sisters. He marries Leah and Rachel. Are you allowed to marry two sisters according to Jewish law? Yes or no? No. Danny's correct. No. But wait a second. Didn't the Avot fulfill all of the mitzvot? Didn't they observe all the mitzvot in the Torah? So how is Yaakov allowed to do that? You know what the answer is?
You weren't Jewish law then.
Okay, so that's one answer. Good. That's one answer. You know what the Ramban's answer is? They were outside the land of Israel. And outside the land of Israel, there is the laws don't apply in the same way. Why? Because the mitzvot are really only supposed to be observed in the land of Israel itself. And that's it. What about everything we do outside of Israel? This is all just preparation. This is hachana. Okay, let's look at the Ramban inside. We read this in Shema every day, and I will, kick you out of the land. Even when you go to Chutz La'aretz, you should still do mitzvot. You know why? Shekishetichzeru lo yiyu alechem chadashim. Shoshana, what does that mean?
You should be familiar with the mitzvot.
What does it mean when about the performance of mitzvot in Chutz La'aretz? It's just preparation. It's just keeping us, in shape. It's keeping us in shape, you know, ready to go. You need to know how to put on tefillin when you get to Israel, so you should put on tefillin in Chutz La'aretz. Okay, that is a very strong statement. Okay, he goes on. Okay, I'm reading right here. Yinei ha-katuv shamar va'avadetem meira v'samtem et v'ray eile. Eino mechayev begalut ele bechovat haguf ketfilinu mezuzot. U'pershu ben kedei shelo yu chadashim alinu kishach solaretz. Ki ikar kol ha-mitzvot v'yoshvim be'eretz Hashem. The real performance of the mitzvot are those who are living in Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, we say in the Sifrei Yerishtemot Tavishavtem Ba, Ushmartem Lasot, you shall inherit the land, you shall dwell in the land, Ushmartem, you shall observe the mitzvot. Because outside the land of Israel, the mitzvot are just preparation. This is a very strong statement on behalf of the Rabbi. And he's saying this is all within model number two. Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz, obviously it's drawn from the Ramban, that in Israel we could perform the mitzvot more fully than anywhere else. Build a Jewish society, build a Beit HaMikdash. There's a story about Rav Yitzchak Kuttner. When he would fly in the plane to Eretz Yisrael, he would put his tefillin on the plane. And then when he got off, when he landed in Ben Gurion Airport, he would put his tefillin on again. He would put it on again. Okay, so this is the opinion of Berkovitz. Now, I want to share the opinion of David Hartman, Rabbi David Hartman here. Okay, and let me just okay. Is this still on screen share? Everyone's still. You can still see this. Good. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Sure. Of course.
Side note, but it says that V'chein Amram, that like Moshe's father, also married two sisters.
Say again. Who did?
The Ramban says that Yaakov was in Chutz La'aretz. He married two sisters, V'chein Amram.
V'chein Amram. Oh, I'm not sure. It's a good question. Maybe Amram married. I don't know. It's a good question. Okay. Maybe he married a wife that he divorced with someone in between. Okay. But again, what's important here? We'll get to Hartman, and then we'll summarize the. We will summarize this viewpoint. Okay, this is Hartman right here. Again, it's from a book, A Living Covenant, The Innovative Spirit in Traditional Judaism. Okay, and he says here, as I have already stated, I do not interpret current events in nature and history as direct expressions of God's will or design. I look exclusively to the Torah and Mitzvot as mediators of the personal God of the covenant. That, however, does not mean that I must adopt Leibowitz's position and ascribe no religious significance to the rebirth of Israel. He's referring here to Yishayahu Leibowitz, chemistry professor at Hebrew University, brother of Nechama Leibowitz, mm-hmm. who believed that there was no religious significance to the rebirth of Israel. From my perspective, the religious meaning one gives to events relates not to their divine origin, but their possible influence on the life of Torah. If an event in history can be a catalyst for new perception of the scope of Torah, if it widens the range of halachic action and responsibility, if it provides greater opportunities for hearing God's mitzvot, this already suffices to endow the event with religious significance, for it intensifies and widens the way God can be present in the daily life of the individual and the community. One can religiously embrace modern Israel not through a judgment about God's actions in history, but through an understanding of the centrality of Israel for the fullest actualization of the world of mitzvot. This covenantal appreciation of history dispenses with the impossible task of, okay, he likes this because he doesn't have to deal with God's intentions here. Okay, which we'll get to in a second. But he says, the Jewish society that we build in Israel has to validate the claim made in the Jewish tradition regarding how a Torah way of life creates a holy community, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. If the Torah is truly capable of sanctifying every aspect of human reality, it's capable of giving new moral and spiritual dimensions to politics. If its ways are ways of pleasantness and all the paths are peace, Torah scholars are a paradigm of the builder of peace. This must be seen and confirmed through the way we live our daily lives and not only proclaimed in our prayers. A community that defines itself by learning and prayer is liable to be seen by the richest of its powers of linguistic expression when evaluating its own moral and religious integrity. The existence of the state of Israel prevents Judaism from being defined exclusively as a culture of learning and prayer. Here, Judaism must draw its pathos also from the exigencies of the concrete needs of life. Not the learning is essential, but the doing then becomes constitutive of Torah study. Learning that excuses one from responsibility for the physical well-being of a nation that provides a conceptual framework with its own inner coherence, but is correspondence to what actually takes place in reality is never tested. May have compelling logical victor and be intellectually fascinating, but it has lost the sanctity of Torah since it has become irrelevant to life itself. This is an opportunity to fulfill the Torah in its concrete form in the land of Israel. Okay, and this is Hartman's view. We're going to come back to Hartman in a little bit. Okay, this is model number two, and this is the again we've seen model number one, Rav Yaakov Yitzchak Yaakov Reines. Israel's a refuge because of anti-Semitism. We've seen model number two now. Israel is an opportunity for mitzvah observance, building a Jewish society, building the Beit HaMikdash, etc., taking responsibility for our destiny. Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz, Rabbi David Hartman. Now we move on to model number three. What distinguishes model number three from two is that model number three is willing to recognize that God played a role here. Okay, and willing to point out, wow, that's God's hands. God is sending us a message here. God has intervened in history in some capacity. Now, model number three is not willing to say that we know exactly what this is. Okay, one phrase, we'll see. We'll see what phrases they're going to use. And with this, we turn to a whole group of American thinkers, American Jewish thinkers, some of them in Israel as well. But most importantly, this is Rav Soloveitchik. This is Rabbi Norman Lamb. This is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, probably fits into this category. Probably also, perhaps, though I'm not sure it's possible, that Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz also fits into this category. To be honest, I'm not 100% sure about that. Did anyone here ever meet Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz? Anyone? Okay. So he was the chief rabbi of England before Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, and we're going to get to him. He had a little bit of a complicated relationship with Zionism, and he wrote a whole book to sort of defend his life experiences. But let's look at Rav Soloveitchik. Now, with Rav Soloveitchik, we are going to look at a book which I have right here called Kol Dodi Dofek. Does anybody have this sefer in their house? Anybody have this? Marilyn, no. Who else is nodding their head? No. Oh my God, this is a travesty.
I tried a couple of Rav Soloveitchik's books very unsuccessfully.
Okay.
And so I didn't buy this.
Okay, this book.
What's it called in English? My Destiny.
Listen, my beloved Knox.
No, what's it really called? Is that what it's called in English?
Yeah. My beloved Knox. Yeah.
I don't think that's the name of it in English.
I think it's called Kol Dodi Dofek.
Yeah, but I think it's called something else.
What's the official? I mean, this is what it says in the. My beloved Knox.
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. The reason why this is a little bit more. I'll use the word understandable, is because it was a lecture that was then written down as opposed to his original writings. His writings can be very complex and rooted in Kantian philosophy, whereas this is a lecture, and his lectures are obviously more understandable.
Based on, right.
So it's I find this also much easier to get through. Now, this is a lecture he gave in 1956, at an Israeli Day independence celebration. This is after this war in Sinai, okay? And Rav Soloveitchik here shares his view of religious Zionism. Now, Rav Soloveitchik becomes the head of Mizrahi, okay? He comes from the most hardcore right-wing Lithuanian family, the Soloveitchik Brisker family, and they are hardcore anti-Zionists. And he breaks with his own family and becomes a religious Zionist, okay? And in Kol Dodi Dofek, he deals with a number of different issues of theodicy. He deals with the nature of the Jewish people and different covenants that we have and how we should relate to this the state of Israel and other Jews who are secular Jews. But he also relates to this notion of God knocking on a door. Okay, he believes that God, that the state of Israel is God knocking on the door. Okay, and we're going to look at Rav Soloveitchik here. Okay, this is actually a resource that's online. Okay, and I'm just gonna go to a source here, and we're gonna read it inside. We're gonna share this document. Okay, I mean, this is a very, I'm just gonna tell you, this is an incredibly inspiring piece. Okay, at least I'll speak for myself. I find it very inspiring. Okay, so let me make this a little bit bigger. Okay, now, what was the, he's going to talk about six knocks, Listen to this. This is awesome stuff. This is why you got to read this book. Okay. I see it's online, by the way. You don't even need to buy it. You can read it all online. So 1 second. I just got to find this part here that I want. That's how we got up. I don't know if you have. Okay. 8 years ago, in the midst of a night of terrors of Majdanek and Treblinka and Buchenwald, and a night of gas chambers and crematoria, and a night of total divine self-concealment, this is how he explains the Holocaust, or at least relates to it, that God concealed himself, and a night ruled by the devil of doubt and destruction who sought to sweep the lover from her own tent into the Catholic Church, okay? In a night of continuous searching for the beloved, meaning, and talking about here, the searching for beloved, us and God, on that very night, the beloved appeared, Hashem appeared. The Almighty, who was hiding in his splendid sanctum, suddenly appeared and began to beckon at the tent of the lover. That's the Jewish people, who tossed and turned on her bed, beset by convulsions of the agonies of hell, the Holocaust. Because of the beating and knocking at the door of the mournful lover, the state of Israel was born. How many times did the beloved knock on the door of the lover? It appears to me that we can count at least 6 knocks. First, the knock of the beloved was heard in the political arena. From the point of view of international relations, no one will deny that the rebirth of the state of Israel in a political sense was almost an almost supernatural occurrence. Both Russia and the Western nations supported the establishment of the state of Israel. This was perhaps, and this is really fascinating, the one resolution on which East and West concurred during the Cold War era. I am inclined to believe that the United Nations was especially created for this end. And for many of us who sometimes find problems with the United Nations, the Rav says it was created for this one moment in history, for the sake of fulfilling the mission that divine providence had placed upon it. It appears to me that one cannot point to any other concrete accomplishment on the part of the United Nations. Our rabbis of the blessed memory already expressed this view. At time, rain falls on account of one individual and for one blade of grass. I do not know who the representatives of the press with their human eyes saw to be the chairman of the faithful session of the General Assembly, which gracious individuals resided, but he looked carefully with his spiritual eyes for the true chairman, meaning God, who conducted the proceedings, the beloved. He knocked with his gavel on the lectern, okay, et cetera, et cetera. So this is, and he says, it's just like on that night, the king could not sleep, meaning that the king of Ahasuerus could not sleep. King could not sleep. If Ahasuerus, so this is referring to the God. God is sort of like the General Assembly in the United Nations becomes an instrument for God's bringing Israel into existence, just like Ahasuerus was an instrument, a tool of God, in the story of Purim. Second, so this is the political arena. Second, the knock of the beloved was heard in the battlefield. The tiny defense forces of the state of Israel defeated the mighty Arab armies. The miracle of the many delivered at the hands of the few materialized before our eyes. An even greater miracle happened. God hardened the heart of Ishmael and commanded him to go into battle against the state of Israel. Had the Arabs not declared war on Israel and instead supported the partition plan, the state of Israel would have remained without Jerusalem, without a major portion of the Galilee, and without some areas in the Negev. If thousands of years ago, Paro had allowed the children to leave immediately as Moses had originally requested, Moses would have been bound by his word to return in 3 days. Okay, next one. Third, the beloved also began to knock on the door of the tent of theology. What was the biggest knock to Christian theology? What was it? The existence of the state of Israel. Because they had said for years that the Jews have been replaced by us, okay? And possibly this is the strongest beckoning. I have on several occasions emphasized in my regards remarks concerning the land of Israel that the theological arguments of Christian theologians, the effect of the Holy One is taken away from the community of Israel, its rights to the land of Israel, and that all of biblical promises relating to Zion and Jerusalem now refer in an allegorical sense to Christianity and the Christian church were all publicly shown to be false. Baseless contentions by the establishment of the state of Israel. Okay, 1 second. We should pay careful attention to the learned explanation of our Secretary of State, Mr. Dulles, who served as a deacon of an Episcopalian church to the Committee of the United Nations Senate, that the Arabs hate the Jews because they killed the founder of their religion. Okay, this, okay, et cetera, et cetera. So, okay, so, 1 second. Okay, so this was the fourth knock, that this was a undermined Christian theology, which had been attacking the Jews for 2,000 years. Fourth, the beloved knocks in the hearts of youth, which is assimilated and perplexed. The period of Hester Panim in the 1940s brought confusion among the Jewish masses and especially Jewish youth. Assimilation increased and the urge to flee from Judaism and the Jewish people reached its apex. Fear, despair, and ignorance caused many to forsake the Jewish community and climb aboard the ship to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. Okay, so young Jews didn't want to be part of Judaism. But suddenly the beloved began to beckon to the hearts of the perplexed, and his beckoning, the establishment of Israel, at least slowed the process of flight. Many who were once alien in their bounds of the Jewish state with ties of pride in its mighty accomplishments. Many American Jews who are partially assimilated find themselves beset by hidden fear. By hidden fear and concern for any crisis that the state of Israel is at the time passing through. So this has created Jewish pride. This has brought people back to Judaism, okay, and people connect to Israel. The very mention of the name Israel is a reminder to the fleeing Jew that he cannot escape the community of Israel, whose midst he has been enmeshed from birth. Everywhere we turn, we hear the name Israel, etc. Okay. And this phenomenon is extremely important for Jews who are afflicted with self-hatred and want to turn away from Judaism and run for their lives. Okay, so this is number four. The fifth knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important. For the first time in the annals of our exile, divine providence has amazed our enemies with the astounding discovery that Jewish blood is not cheap. The anti-Semites describe this phenomenon as being an eye for an eye. We will agree with them. If we want to courageously defend our continued national historical existence, we must from time to time interpret the verse of an eye for an eye for an eye literally. Wow, he's saying we need to interpret an eye for an eye literally. So many eyes were lost in the course of our bitter exile because we did not repay hurt for hurt. The kind time has come for us to fulfill the simple meaning of an eye for an eye. Meaning, Jewish blood is not cheap. However, with respect to the Mufti and Nasser, I would demand that we interpret the verse in accordance with its literal meaning, the taking of an actual eye. Pay no attention to the saccharine suggestions of known assimilationists, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, revenge is forbidden when it is pointless, but if one is aroused there by self-defense, it is the most elementary right of man to take his revenge. Wow, Jewish blood is not cheap. Okay, we have to defend ourselves, and that's what happened with the state of Israel. Let's go on. Okay, here, the antidote for this venom. Let us not forget that the poison of Hitlerite anti-Semitism, which made Jews all fair game to all, still permeates its generation, which looked with equanimity upon the horrible scene of the suffocation of millions in gas chambers as a normal event that need not be challenged. The antidote for this venom that poisoned minds and dulled heart is the readiness of the state of Israel to defend the lives of its citizens. Listen, my beloved Knox. The sixth beckoning was the opening of the gates of Israel, that Jews had a place to go to, Kibbutz Galiot, that we have shelter and that we have a place to return to Eretz Israel. Okay, and this is, you know, millions of Jews have returned from Oriental lands, from Western lands, and these are the six knocks. Now, Rav Soloveitchik is not saying here, notice that there's one key word that's missing from here. What's missing from here?
Redemption.
There's no mention of redemption. Mashiach is not mentioned, no Atchalta de Geula. But we can call this a redemptive moment, perhaps. This God is knocking on the door. God is certainly intervening in history. Okay? He's not willing to say that this is the redemption. We don't know if this is a redemption. He doesn't go there. Okay? But he is willing to say that certainly God has intervened, and this is a unique, a distinct, a wondrous, that's the right word, a wondrous moment in Jewish history. Okay? So this is the third model. And you have to read the whole essay. Please, I beg you, read the whole essay. I'm going to send you all the link. I'm even going to put it on now so that I don't forget. Sometimes I forget to do things. And I'm putting this on right now so that everybody has the link. Okay, you can copy it into your own computer, your Google Chrome, and you'll have it. And this way you could, if you have nothing to do the rest of the day, you can, I'm going to put this in here as well. Okay, that's a cold Odido fake. Okay, so it's now in the group there. Good, I heard a ping. Yafe. Okay, let's move on now to the fourth model. And the fourth model is the model set forth by Rev Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. And this is what we're going to call the Messianic model. Okay, The Messianic model believes that we are living in the times of redemption. And there are many sources to prove this. The Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin teaches us that Kishe'eretz Yisrael notenet perotei ba'ayin yafa, when the land of Israel is you know, the trees grow again, and the land is tilled, and agriculture returns. This is the story of Israel. There were swamps in Emek Yisrael, right? And we came back, you look outside and see how green Eretz Yisrael. We've turned, we have made the desert bloom. Well, guess what? This is a sign of the Mashiach, okay? And this is one of the ideas that Rav Kook brings up. This notion is continued by his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. Now, I just want to give you some examples of how this plays out. So Rav Kook gave a famous lecture, a eulogy, actually, when Herzl passes away. Okay. This may have been, it wasn't in 1904, maybe like 20, it's like on the, I think, the yurt side of Herzl. And he speaks in messianic terminology. And I want to share with you what he says. We're going to go back to the source sheet. Okay. Okay, I'm just going to share again. Okay, and we're looking here at a, one second. We're looking here at the messianism model, which he's his model number four, which he, this is a lecture he delivers on the death of Herzl, okay? So upon his return to, let's read inside here. Okay, in a remarkable eulogy entitled The Eulogy in Jerusalem, delivered after Theodor Herzl's death in 1904, Rav Kook explained his concept of two messiahs. The eulogy beautifully articulates his views on the secular Zionist movement and the tragic rift between the religious and secular sectors of the religious people. Rav Kook is going to say there are two Mashiachs. There's Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David. Well, guess what? Who's associated with Mashiach ben Yosef? Anybody know?
Herzl.
Mm-hmm. Herzl, okay? He doesn't say that he's Mashiach ben Yosef, but he's bringing about the movement, if you will, of Mashiach ben Yosef. Now, what does he say here? God, this is a summary. It's not the exact lecture, but it captures all the ideas. God created us with body and soul. We have forces that maintain and strengthen the body and forces that protect and develop the soul. The ideal is to have a robust body together with a strong and healthy soul. The soul, with its remarkable faculties, is meant to utilize the body to fulfill God's will in this world. The Jewish people function in an analogous fashion to the body and the soul. There are forces in the nation that correspond to the body, working to meet its material and physical needs. These forces prepare a firm basis for Israel's holy mission. And there are forces in the nation that work directly toward developing Israel's special spiritual qualities. So, and here we now get to the two messiahs. So these two tasks were divided between two tribes, Joseph and Judah. Joseph looked after the material needs of the Israelites in Egypt, right? Joseph was the one who takes care of his brothers. He gives them food. The sages taught that Joseph spoke 70 languages, etc. Judah, on the other hand, was responsible for cultivating the special holiness of the Jewish people. Judah became his holy nation. Now, what happens ultimately, and I'm not going to read through this whole thing, is that there was a split in the kingdom between the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Yehuda, and then the spiritual and the physical were split, okay? But in the time of redemption, you know, these two forces will be brought back together. One second. Okay, the fall of Mashiach ben Yosef. The Talmud in Sukkah 52a teaches that Mashiach ben Yosef will be killed and that a great eulogy in Jerusalem will be delivered at his death. What is the significance of this piercing eulogy when the nation will mourn the loss of Mashiach ben Yosef as one mourns for an only child? Due to the rift within the Jewish people, these two forces clash. Those who promote the nation's material aspects belittle the importance of Torah and Mitzvot, and those who stress the special nature of Israel reject all changes and attempts to better its material standing. This leads to rebellion against religion on one side and anemic stagnation on the other. With the fall of Mashiach ben Yosef, all will realize that these are not opposing movements, but forces that should work together so that material progress will form a basis for developing the unique character of the nation. This is the significance of the great eulogy in Jerusalem. All sectors of the nation will mourn this loss. All recognize that it is a tragic mistake for these forces to be divided and estranged from one another. So what we have here is the idea that Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David represent different parts of the Jewish people, but they will fuse back together and be synthesized in the time of redemption. And Rav Kook believes that we've come to that stage in Jewish history, and that is what's represented by Herzlian political Zionism. That's at least the physical part. And these two forces, the spiritual and the physical, which are at odds, will realize that they both need each other. This is very, how shall we say, optimistic and hopeful. And Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Kook believed that secular Zionists would return to their neshama, they would return to their Jewish faith and come back to the Jewish faith, even though they had rejected it. Was he right about this? Did this happen? Well, yes and no. There's no doubt that one could argue that the secular Chiloni hegemony doesn't exist in Israel anymore. You know, the Labor Party used to have like 70 seats in the Knesset. The Labor Party, was like down to 3 or something at this point, right? And they joined the Netanyahu government. But not everybody is Chozer B'Tshuva as Rav Kook believed they would. And so, there's a challenge when you put everyone, when you try to, sort of write everybody into your messianic vision and it doesn't play out exactly as you expect it to. But that's a side point. But Rav Kook does speak in clear messianic terminology. His son also did. And, many yeshivot in the world of you could really split the world of yeshivot hezder, Israeli yeshivot, into two groups. You have the camp of Yeshivat Haratzion Megush and the camp of Merkaz. Merkaz was Rav Kook's yeshiva, and they've spawned many yeshivot from each of them. And the world of the Gush is more in model number 3, and the world of Merkaz is very clearly in model number 4, messianic. I'll just give you one example. This sefer that I have here, Vayiyadav Emunah. Yeshivot Takat. Vayiyadav Emunah, which was composed by Rav Eli Sadan. He started the Mechinot movement, Mechina movement. He runs Eli, a very prestigious pre-army Mechina. And, this is his collection of his essays and stuff. And the first page, if I just look at the first page, he's very squarely in the Rav Kook camp. The first page is about Atchalta de Geula. We are living in the time of redemption. And we have to hear this call, and we have to recognize our responsibility at this point and this moment in Jewish history. And he traces back, not just to Rav Kook, but to the time of the Vilna Gaon, that there were indications that Mashiach is on his way, and this is all part of the process of returning to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so now, this is the... Now I want to deal with a little bit of a critique of these different models. What's a critique that one might have of the third model? Critique might you have of Rav Soloveitchik's model, for example?
That it's only messianic.
Say again, what?
That it's only messianic.
No, but Rav Soloveitchik says no. That's what he says. But what might be a critique of Rav Soloveitchik's model? What might be a challenge to his model?
Well, I think the major challenge to Soloveitchik's model is that Soloveitchik himself didn't follow it.
Why not? Because he didn't move to Israel?
Not make Aliyah. His son, okay, who was in Israel for a few years, went back.
Okay, so I don't want to think about it on a personal level, but let's think about it, conceptually. The challenge with Soloveitchik's model is, one might argue, Rav Soloveitchik, you're missing the ship here. You're missing the big picture. Like, if this is not the time of Mashiach, what is? You know what I'm saying? Like, you're sort of missing the boat. That's the phrase I wanted to use. You're missing the boat. Like how do you not see more in this than just a divine knock? That might be the argument on that level. The argument on the other end of and this I want to bring in Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz. Is the challenge to Rav Kook is, things can get a little bit dangerous when you start talking in messianic terminology. Because the Jewish people have run into problems when we start thinking about Mashiach. Okay? Yeah. Think of the Bar Kokhba revolt, which was an epic, epic failure. Okay? Think of Shavtai Tzvi. That was a major, major catastrophe for the Jewish people. Some might make the case, and they have to, but that where parts of where Chabad is going is concerning, okay, a little bit. I'm going to leave that as an open question, but that is, you know, that's another, you know, example. But we get into trouble when we start talking about Mashiach because we want to bring things to the end of history. And we get a little bit, I don't want to use the delusional is not the right word, but we get caught up in the fervor. That's the right term. And Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz deals with this in his book, okay? In a chapter, the book is called If Only My People, Zionism in My Life. And he says here, 1 second. Okay. 1 second. Okay. I'm going to read to you the two sides of this. Okay, so there, he speaks about the moderates, you know, like Rav Soloveitchik. By the way, Rav Avad Yosef also might be one of the moderates, okay? As we'll see why in just a second, what he said about land for peace. He says, leading the fierce opposition to these moderates is the Gush Emuni movement, which was started in, you know, post-73 war, and felt there was a need to build Eretz Yisrael Hashlema. You know, we have to settle Yehuda v'Shomron, which has gathered formidable strength since the Yom Kippur War, and which, despite its purely religious motivation, now enjoys widespread support among other ultranationalists as well. The later of Cook's passionate commitment to a Jewish self-redemption land of Israel is frequently recited as a vindication of the Gush Emunim platform today. But careful students of his prolific and inspired writings are inclined to challenge this posthumous invocation of support for a contrived eschatology of confrontation and militancy as alien to his pacific teachings and mellow character. He saw Rav Kook as being a mild, mellow character, not militant. He's essentially accusing the Gush Emuni movement of certain militancy. For others, the battle cry "not an inch" with its all or nothing overtones evokes ominous echoes of the Masada experience, an episode quite unique in Jewish history. Unique not because of its heroic martyrdom, but because of the declared preference by an extreme religious sect for national euthanasia or death, with dignity over life under foreign subjugation, for which Jewish history has no parallel. So he sees, you know, a very right-wing Gush Emuni movement as sort of following in the path of Masada, which was saying, well, we're going to die, you know, because we would never want to have, you know, any foreigners tell us what to do or rule us here in the land of Israel. Even more disturbing to the religious historical sensitivities of many are the messianic undercurrents of this religious radicalism. The pages of Jewish history are littered with the debris, sometimes the lethal shrapnel, left behind by the explosion of pseudo-messianic movements as grim reality dashed with shattering force the high expectations of imminent deliverance they had raised. The bitter wounds inflicted by the devastating disillusionment stretched from the collapse of the Bar Kokhba rebellion and to the fearful aftermath of the Tzvi debacle. As will be explained in the next words, there is all the difference between messianic hopes, which constitute the very stuff of faith, serving our people to prevail over our tribulations, and messianic expectations of impending salvation. So he's willing to say, hey, there are messianic hopes here that it might be fulfilled, but not actual expectations. And final sentence of this will conclude, basing national policies or religious guidance on such assumptions can lead to catastrophic consequences against which we are forewarned by ample dangerous signals flashed from the shipwrecks of messianic disasters spread along the course of our annals for the past 2,000 years. He doesn't want government policy in the land of in Medinat Israel to be run by messianic notions. Okay, mm-hmm. And I remember very clearly when there was old discussion about the Hidnatkut, right? And what you call it, the Gerush, the Hidnatkut, I know it's loaded. You know, Ariel Sharon, you know, told parts of the Tilumi community, you're too influenced by messianism. And that's what he said then. He thinks, you think you have to have Eretz Yisrael Hashlema? Well, we're making political decisions that we think are right from a military political standpoint. I don't want to venture into who is right. There's a lot to say about 20 years later and what, you know, whether it was a good decision or not a good decision. But the point is that how these factors play into decision-making from a theological and political standpoint. And this is model number 4. Okay, so just to summarize, We go from minimalist to more maximalist. Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, refuge of Eretz Yisrael. Model number two, expanding the ability to perform mitzvot and build our own Jewish culture. That's Rav Eliezer Berkovitz and David Hartman. Model number three, Rav Soloveitchik. This is the knocks on the door that we're living. You know, God has intervened in history. And that's number three. Number four is that we're living in the time of Mashiach. Now, I do recommend that everybody read Kol Dodi Dofek this week. It's 100 pages. It's such a short, beautiful pamphlet. And you'll see that he believes that this comes with obligations. Okay, and we're going to see what he thinks the knocks at the door demand of us. Hey, you have to be willing to open up the door, right? And go in and take responsibility for this. So lots to continue to discuss here. For next week, we have next week. We're going to continue next week. I think we're going to jump into next week. We're going to do a number of parts on Judaism encounters egalitarianism and feminism. Okay, so we're going to do sort of those two things together. It's going to be an expanded topic. There's lots to say about this. Okay, so wishing everybody a great day, a good week. Thank you for your flexibility in meeting today. And I'm going to post all the information on the WhatsApp group so you could all download it and print it if you would like to. Okay, Kol Tov, Yom Tov, Lekulam.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.